Welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, my dear audience. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Micro. As always, I hope you had a great week. And of course, you can always find Let's Talk Micro on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Goodpods. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find Let's Talk Micro. As far as social media, I am on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, on X as Let's Talk Micro 1, on Blue Sky Social as Let's Talk Micro, on LinkedIn as Luis Plaza, and I have an email address which is letstalkmicro@outlook.com. So either via social media or via email, you can reach out with any suggestions, any feedback. They are always welcome and appreciated. So please go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, download episodes, and if the app allows you to do so, please go ahead and leave a review. Thank you so much for the support. And as you know, the Let's Talk Micro podcast does not have any sponsors. So if you want to support the podcast in any way, you can do so via Venmo or via Buy Me a Coffee, KOFI, both links available on the show notes. And of course, if you are looking to learn more about antibiotics, please check out www.learnantibiotics.com and the Learn Antibiotics book available on Amazon. These resources include cheat sheets, practice tests, games, and more, and they are being used by thousands of people worldwide and may be helpful for you or your colleagues. So definitely check out these great resources from Dr. Timothy Gauthier, a very passionate pharmacist. If you haven't checked out the previous episode, please go ahead and do so. It was a great episode and was actually the next episode on the AMR series with Andrea Prinzi. And of course, for the benefit of those that are just tuning in, so if this is your first time listening to the podcast, first of all, welcome. And I'm just going to take a quick moment to tell you about the AMR series. So within the podcast, we created a series which is about antimicrobial resistance, and we basically started from the beginning. So we just started breaking down antimicrobials. So we go over things like mechanism of action, intrinsic resistance, which organisms does the drug has activity against. Definitely, you know, we try to explain things as simple as we can. And in that series, you know, typically I do the podcast alone. But for that series, I do have a co-host, which is Andrea Prinzi. She's a fellow microbiologist. And we just, you know, bring a guest and we go over the different classes of antimicrobials. Because by now we have gone pretty much over most of the classes. We started with beta-lactams and we have done tetracyclines, aminoglycosides, fluoroquinolones. So if you haven't checked out any of the episodes, I definitely invite you to go ahead and do so. You know, check them out, download them and listen to them. You know, they have some great guests, great topics, great conversations, and this last one was not an exception. So in the last episode, we went over the class, the oxazolidinones. Definitely a mouthful, right? So this was very fun because the episode started, you know, and as we started, Andrea was talking about how to pronounce the group, and then our guest, David Allen, asked her to go ahead and pronounce it. And she went ahead and did it, and it was great. She pronounced it correctly, so it was fun. And you might not be familiar with this name, you know, with this class of antibiotics, but definitely if you perform testing in the lab, you know the name of one antibiotic in this group. And maybe by now, those of you that are seasoned microbiologists, you might know the antibiotic. And if you don't, that's okay. That's what we're here for, right? To talk about things and learn together. So one antibiotic in this group is linezolid. And if you work in the lab, definitely if you perform testing, right, if you do susceptibility testing, I'm sure you have done testing for Enterococcus, and one of the antibiotics that gets tested is linezolid. It is definitely part of some Vita cards used for susceptibility testing for gram-positive organisms. So definitely, all in all, it was a great episode, so check it out if you haven't already. And before I move on to today's episode, you know, just circling back to the AMR series, after we go over the classes of antibiotics, then we're planning on going over mechanisms and diving into that, which I know it's definitely very complicated, but we'll try to, you know, we'll try our best. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about today's episode. There is no guest, so it is me talking about an organism. So as always, if you enjoyed this type of episode, it is for you. And if you prefer the episodes with guests, definitely I please ask you to go ahead and, you know, stay and listen to this one. You know, it has some great content, so definitely I'm looking forward to talking about this with you. Okay, so those of you who listen regularly know that I have had by now Dr. Kelly Maddock in the podcast twice. and she is the section head of microbiology at the North Dakota State University Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. And the first episode that we did, you know, it was with her and Sarah Gerfro, and it was about veterinary microbiology. And maybe you might not be aware of this, but as an MLS, you can work in a veterinary lab and do lab testing. So in the episode, they talked about testing in the lab, you know, we talked about organisms, and it was definitely a very fun episode. And it was recorded last year, but recently I re-released it, so you should see it at the top of your list. So if you haven't checked that one out, definitely please go ahead and do so. And then the episode, the second episode that Kelly did was about Pastorella multocida and capsular types. And that one was actually published 2 weeks ago. So definitely check it out if you haven't already. And in the episode, you know, she mentions different animals where different capsule types are seen. She talks about hemorrhagic septicemia and a model they developed to look for capsular types using MALDI-TOF MS. And you know that Pastorella is my favorite organism, and in 2021 I recorded an episode where I talked about why is it my favorite. So you see where I'm going with this. By now we're combining that, you know, Kelly came in, she talked about Pastorella and capsular types, and you combine that with the fact that I did do an episode in 2021, but it was brief, and I just briefly went over different species and talked about biochemicals. So I thought this was a good time to go over Pastorella. And instead of a brief overview, we're going to do a deeper dive. So I'm going to give it a shot, but just letting you know, Kelly did a great job talking about the capsular types, so I'm just going to leave that for that episode. So let's go ahead and give it a shot. Well, Pastorella is part of the family Pastorellaceae, and this family has over 25 genera. Other examples of this genera are Haemophilus, Actinobacillus, and Agregatibacter. And as you know, taxonomy is something that might cause stress in the microbiology community. You know, there's always so many changes we have to keep up. And I mentioned this before when we do MALDI-TOF now, you know, MALDI-TOF MS. And now we're seeing all these names and we have all these changes. So sometimes, you know, it might be a little stressful keeping up, and you get all these reclassifications and things like that. So it is not fun. But, you know, it's something that happens as more and more molecular testing is done and things like, you know, gene sequencing, and then you discover that one organism is more similar to another one or is different enough from another one to be its own, you know, genus. So it happens, and we might not like it, but that's just the way it is. And having said that, this family is no stranger to that, and many renaming and reclassifications are taking place. But, you know, let's go ahead and stick to Pastorella and save that topic for another day. Okay, so if you're listening, you're a microbiologist, or, you know, you're going through a medical lab sciences program, maybe you went already, and you're definitely familiar with some species of Pastorella, right? So which ones are you familiar with? And I think that you're definitely thinking about Pastorella multocida and Pastorella canis, and I'm sure that, you know, those are the ones. They're the ones most commonly seen in the lab, so those, I'm sure that those, you know, pop in your mind. Well, other species include Pastorella aeruginis, Betiae, Dagmatis, Cavalli, and Oralis. Pastorella multocida has some subspecies, which are Pastorella multocida, subspecies multocida, Pastorella multocida, subspecies septica, and Pastorella multocida, subspecies gallocida. And if you're a microbiologist, you know that there are some organisms that are part of our normal flora, right? And we know, depending on different areas, right, that we have Eikenella in our respiratory flora, we have, you know, Enterobacterales in our enteric flora. And when it comes to humans, Pastorella is not part of our flora. However, I found something interesting in Bailey and Scott's Diagnostic Microbiology, which is a big resource that I use for the podcast. And that interesting note that I found is that Pastorella might be found in the upper respiratory flora of humans that have long-term exposure to animals such as farmers. And of course, that's something that makes complete sense, right? Because as you know, you have, if you're exposed to animals, you know, and you're constantly working with them, and you know, you're handling animals, and there are some common surfaces, so it will make sense that, you know, you will get some of those organisms in your flora. But as you know, Pastorella is part of some animals' microbiota, you know, some part of the flora. so it is seen in a variety of healthy and diseased animals. Out of the species mentioned, Passerella multocida, Canis, Stomatis, Oralis, Erogenes, and Degmatis are isolated from humans. And since these organisms, you know, are seen in a variety of animals, you know, it will make sense that when we see them in humans, you know, one common mode of transmission will be bites, right? So when the samples that you're commonly seeing in the lab, you know, there are product of bites. So you get those wound cultures that are, you know, from tissue infections. So whether you are in a big lab and compartmentalized and you have like a separate wound bench, or you have a smaller lab, you will typically see this, you know, these organisms and cultures that the source is a wound. So let's go ahead and, you know, spend a few moments talking about which animals. So Passerella multocida is found at higher levels in cats and dogs. Passerella canis is found in dogs. Passerella erogenes is found in pigs. And I shared this before, but if you're listening, you know, I'm gonna share it again. And when I talk about media, I'll talk more about Passerella erogenes, but it was definitely, I remember the first time that I had it. And it was very amazing for me because I learned so much, because I mentioned this before, but sometimes, you know, when you're going through like a medical lab science program and maybe you touch on some of the organisms, but one of the things that you learn about Passerella, and I'll go over this when I talk about media, but that is that, you know, most species, they do not grow McConkey. So, but Passerella erogenes does. And I didn't know that. And when I saw an ID of Passerella, I was skeptical, but then I did the research and I found out that yes, Passerella erogenes can grow McConkey. Anyway, it was an amazing nerd moment, so I really loved it. Well, let's go back to talking about Passerella and animals. So Passerella caballus is found in pigs and equines. Passerella degmatis and stomatis are primarily found in dogs and cats. And something interesting when it comes to Passerella beriae, it's that it tends to be recovered from genitourinary samples, and this suggests a possible sexual transmission. And as I was doing the research for this episode, you know, I read that there is uncertainty regarding the habitat of P. beriae. And as I mentioned, the primary mode of transmission of Passerella to humans is by contact, and bites are the most common. And another example is by the animal licking a wound. So let's go ahead and talk about pathogenesis. And since the primary mode of transmission is bites, a common infection associated with Passerella, you know, most species, is soft tissue infections. But there is definitely more than that. You know, Passerella multocida is associated with other infections at a lower level of wounds, you know, of tissue infections. So meaning that there are lower occurrences. So, and the examples of these are respiratory infection, meningitis, osteomyelitis, endocarditis, and dialysis-based peritonitis, among others. And there is a risk factor for systemic disease, which is liver cirrhosis. So out of the different subspecies of Passerella multocida, the subspecies Passerella multocida is the most frequently isolated and is associated with respiratory infections and bacteremia. And then Passerella multocida subspecies septica is associated with wound infections and central nervous system infections. Passerella degmatis has been reported in some systemic infections such as pneumonia, septicemia, and endocarditis. Passerella beriae is associated with genital tract infections and has been seen in neonatal infections. When it comes to virulence factors, for the most species they are unknown, but there are definitely some in Passerella multocida. And they are endotoxins, cytotoxins, and capsules. And this is the part where I refer you to Kelly's episode, which was episode 166, because she does a beautiful job of talking about the capsules. And, you know, so I'm not going to do it justice. So definitely check that episode to learn more about that. And Kelly is a veterinary microbiologist. So that episode, you know, when it's about Passerella, you know, definitely focuses on animals. And here, you know, I'm talking more about humans, but definitely a great job talking about the capsules. So check out that episode. And just one more thing about that episode, when she talks about the capsules, you know, she talks about hemorrhagic septicemia associated with capsules, and she talks about that. So definitely a great episode. so check it out if you haven't already. Okay, so now that we have talked about pathogenesis, let's talk about lab stuff, right? So we are microbiologists. If you work on the bench, you want to know things like, right, media, morphology, biochemicals, antimicrobials. So let's start with the basics. Let's go ahead and start with the gram stain. They are short gram-negative rods, some being coccobacillary, and the textbooks make mention of Pasteurella aeruginase being very coccobacillary. And for Pasteurella bettyae, the rods might be thinner than others. And when it comes to forms that are coccobacillary, and this is something that I have talked to my students about and I have talked to techs about, right? Because I know that especially when you're learning, coccobacilli can be confusing. And, right, you're looking at them and it's, you know, is it a cocci? Is it a rod? They're so tiny. So as you learn and you do gram stains, definitely I really encourage gram stain as much as you can. It really helps you. And remember that if you find yourself looking at a gram stain, you have something that's gram negative. And as you're looking at it, you know, it's very tiny and you can't really tell, you know, you can't tell if it's a rod or a cocci. You know, you're looking at it and I'm like, I just can't tell. The probabilities are that you either have a Haemophilus or you have a Pasteurella. So remember that. And if you're looking at a gram stain, if you see rods, so you see these tiny things, you know, you don't know if they're cocci or rods, but as you are looking at it and you scan your slide, you see some that you can clearly tell that they are rod shaped, then you have gram negative rods. And I tell you this because I just want to make sure that you don't mistakenly report something as a gram negative cocci. When you think about gram negative cocci, you think about kidney beans, right? And they are larger than your gram negative coccobacilli. So if you're in the lab, if you're a student, I want to challenge you to perform multiple gram stains. So go ahead and grab an Acinetobacter, grab like an Neisseria gonorrhea, grab a Moraxella, and then grab a Haemophilus and a Pasteurella and do a comparison. And you're going to see that while, you know, for example, Acinetobacter, you get these plump coccobacillary rods, but they're definitely larger. And then gram-negative cocci, they're smaller than that. And your coccobacilli are smaller than both of them. So anyway, just keep that in mind. And when you find yourself having a hard time, you know, I can't tell what's happening. You know, I don't know if it's a gram-negative cocci or a rod. You probably have a Pasteurella or a Haemophilus. Okay, so now that we know about the gram stain, Pasteurella, you know, they are non-motile and they are glucose fermenters. And as far as media, they grow in blood and chocolate agar. And I mentioned this when I talked about Pasteurella aeruginase, but most of them do not grow McConkie. And the exceptions are Pasteurella aeruginase and some strains of Pasteurella bettyae. And in the textbooks, you know, there's mention that they might look like lactose fermenters on McConkie. But I'm not too sure about that. I mean, the colonies are small. And then to me, they look like they may be like a dull pink kind of. But I wouldn't call them, you know, lactose fermenters. Or better said, not call them, but think that they are. I wouldn't think that. So before we continue going, just let me touch real quick on my story. So as I mentioned, you know, I went through the program and the medical lab sciences program, and you learn about the organisms, but sometimes, you know, you're moving fast-paced. And when I went through, we had one semester of parasitology and then one semester where we had bacteriology, you know, mycology. So there was a lot of material for one semester. So you kind of, maybe you stuck to learning about the classics. And I definitely knew that Pasteurella, you know, grew in blood, grew in chocolate, but did not grow in MAC. And one day I'm working on the bench and then I see an organism that's growing on blood, chocolate, and McConkie. And I see that a Vitek ID was done. And the ID was Pasteurella aeruginase. And I kind of, you know, I was dubious and I wasn't sure what to think of that. But before I talked to my supervisor, I'm like, let me go ahead and do a little bit of research. So I pulled my books. You know, I remember looking at the Manual of Clinical Microbiology from the American Society for Microbiology. And don't quote me on this. I think it was the 9th edition. I remember the books were like a dark green. And there it said that out of the Pasteurella species, you know, Pasteurella aeruginase grows on McConkie and it is seen in pig bites. So that led me to check the patient's history, and there it was. The patient actually sustained a pig bite, which is kind of odd in Orlando, right? But But, you know, it might not be a great story, but I remember that day and I enjoyed it so much that it was just, you know, I learned, and that's something about this field that I love, that, you know, you get to learn new things. And the field changes and the organisms, they don't read textbooks, right, like we say. So we find some abnormal things, some, you know, weird morphologies, weird things growing, and I don't know, it's fascinating. And I always like to make the disclaimer that, yes, it is fascinating from the learning point of view, but of course, you know, these organisms, you know, they mean that the patient might be going through some sort of infectious process, and that's not good, right? So I just want to keep that clear. When it comes to morphology, the colonies, you know, they have like a grayish color. They are non-hemolytic. They're smaller than other colonies, you know, as compared to, let's say, the Enterobacterales. And while you should never smell plates, right, but sometimes, you know, you get some smells coming, and I think Pasteurella has like some sort of musty odor. It's definitely very peculiar, so you know you have it when those notes hit you. As far as biochemicals, they are oxidase positive, but keep in mind that sometimes, you know, you get some weaker reactions, so it's not that beautiful oxidase that, let's say, you have with like an Neisseria, or you have with like a non-fermenting gram-negative rod, like Pseudomonas aeruginosa, for example. So a lot of times, and those of you that work in the lab, you know, sometimes, you know, we do oxidase testing on filter paper, right? So we flood the paper with the reagent, and then we use a stick, we grab the colony, and then we touch. But when it comes to Pasteurella, I think it works best when you do the swab. And even then, sometimes you don't even see a reaction, or if you do, it's very weak. So keep that in mind when you're doing testing. When it comes to indole, most species are indole positive. However, Pasteurella aeruginosa and Caballus are indole negative. And these two biochemicals are the most commonly performed on these organisms. But however, you know, most of the species are catalase positive. Pasteurella betiae and Caballi are catalase negative. And all species reduce nitrate to nitrite. Okay, so now that you know about morphology and biochemicals and Gram stain, I'm sure you want to know about susceptibility, so I'm just going to briefly touch on it. And as I do, I want to point you towards the CLSI documents, you know, in the AMR series, and outside of that also, I always point to the text to make sure that you get familiar with your CLSI. And I always talk about the CLSI M100, and that's where you actually find most of your organisms, you know, your very commonly encountered organisms in the lab, like Staph, Enterococcus, Strep, Enterobacterales, non-fermenting gram-negative rods. And when it comes to Pasteurella, you can find information about it on the CLSI M45. Both resources, you can find them online for free. And besides Pasteurella, you find other organisms there. Like, you know, you can find the CLSI M45. You find information about like Eikenella, Lactobacillus, Micrococcus. So definitely, I want to give you homework and go ahead and get familiar with those documents. And you can, as I said, you know, you can find them for free, and it is as easy as going on a search engine and typing free CLSI M100, and that takes you to a website where you have to enter an email, and there you can find both CLSI M100 and CLSI M45. And when it comes to Pasteurella, the CLSI M45, and it does this not only for Pasteurella but for other organisms, so you get information about what type of media to use, the incubation temperatures. So when it comes to Pasteurella, you can use Müllers Hinton blood, and then you incubate it in a non-CO2 incubator. And the CLSI M45, you know, it gives you breakpoints for this diffusion, and it also gives you MICs, which is minimum inhibitory concentration. And something interesting about Pasteurella, it's susceptibility to penicillin. And why is this interesting is because, you know, penicillin does not have activity against most of the commonly encountered gram-negatives in clinical settings because they are intrinsically resistant to it. So that's something, you know, that's something interesting to learn about. And Pasteurella species are typically susceptible to most agents used to treat bacterial infections. There is some resistance to erythromycin. And I want to share something interesting from the Manual of Clinical Microbiology, and it says that susceptibilities may be warranted when isolates are obtained from normally sterile sites, and a beta-lactamase test should be performed, including on isolates from respiratory infections. And the manual also says that susceptibility testing is not necessary for isolates from wound infections, since they are empirically treated with agents used for this type of infections. So I am definitely curious to know whether you perform susceptibilities on all Pasteurella, or maybe you don't do any because, you know, your lab doesn't have the capabilities, but I would like to know, so maybe reach out via email or via social media and let me know if your lab only performs susceptibility on Pasteurella from, you know, like sterile sites, or maybe if you do them across the board. Let me know. I'm really curious. Okay, so let's go ahead and do a quick recap. Today we went over different species of Pasteurella, which, you know, they are found in many animals, including cats, dogs, pigs. And I went over different species. And in the lab, you know, definitely very common is to see Pasteurella multocida, Pasteurella canis, and others that I mentioned. And Pasteurella is not part of our flora as far as humans, but it might be found as part of the flora on people that are exposed to animals long term. And a great example was farmers. And since these organisms are typically found in animals, a common mode of transmission to humans, you know, it's contact, such as bites. And the primary infection is, you know, soft tissue infections, which is why you typically see Pasteurella, like in the wound bench, let's say. As far as gram stain, they are sure gram negative rods, some of them being coccobacillary. They grow in blood and chocolate. Pasteurella arbuginis and Bettyi grow McConkey, the others do not. All species are oxidase positive and mostly indole positive as well, with some exceptions. And when it comes to virulence factors, as I mentioned, they are unknown for most species, but however, for Pasteurella multocida, you have things like capsules, which Dr. Maddock does a great job. So once again, I want to point you to check out that episode so you can, you know, complement this episode with that one. And I just want to make sure, as I wrap the episode for the text, definitely as we get things like Molditov, and maybe you don't have Molditov, but sometimes, you know, people don't want to do gram stains, and most of these species, they do not grow MAC. So remember that, and don't assume that, because that's one of the biggest mistakes you can make as a tech, is assuming that it is gram positive because it is not growing on MAC. So definitely, as always, you know, look at the patient's history, perform biochemicals, and as you're learning, definitely continue making use of the gram stain. Even if you're experienced, you know, it is a great tool, and I cannot stress that enough. It's going to help you out, but most important, it's going to prevent you from making a mistake. And as you know, in our job, our mistakes, you know, can affect the lives of patients, which is what we do this for, right? So always make sure you do the best job you can. And that is achieved by education and repetition, getting familiar with your resources. That way, when you sit on that bench, you do your best. And that's what we want. And that, my dear audience, it's the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed this deeper dive on Pasteurella. As always, I enjoy sharing this information with you, and I definitely enjoy talking about Pasteurella. It is my favorite organism. So I hope this benefits you somehow, and check out the other episode because, you know, it is such a fascinating organism. So stay tuned. Great things coming your way. And definitely, as you are listening to this, maybe if you're listening on Friday, December 13th, you know, the episode is going to publish on Thursday, December 12th, but on Friday, I am graduating and receiving my master's degree. I finished. I did it. Thank you so much for your support, for your understanding, which sometimes I couldn't post any episodes, but I reached the finish line, and it feels great. Thank you so much. So please, continue bringing that passion to what you do. It is so important. You do such great work. So, as always, stay motivated, stay safe, and of course, continue talking micro. Until the next time. Bye.